Hello and welcome to Small Batches with me, Adam Hawkins. I'm your guide to software delivery excellence. In each episode, I share a small batch of the theory and practices along the path. Topics include DevOps, Lean, continuous delivery, and conversations with industry leaders. Now, let's begin today's episode. I have a returning guest on for this episode. Dave Mango was one of the first guests on Small Batches. He came on the show to discuss the book, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. Today, Dave joins me to discuss his own book, DevOps Patterns for Private Equity. Dave and I go into why he wrote the book, and I pick his brain on some of my own recurring challenges. Before hearing from Dave, though, there is still 1 week to enter the March book giveaway. This month, I'm giving away a free signed copy of Katie Anderson's book, Learning to Lead, Leading to Learn. I had Katie on the podcast last month. Check out that episode to learn more about her and the book. Though there is something even more special about this month's giveaway. The book is actually signed by 2 people, Katie Anderson and Isao Yoshino. That is so cool and a very special present from Katie to all of you Small Batches listeners. The giveaway runs through March 2024. Entries are limited to United States mailing addresses. Go to my LinkedIn for entry details. All right, now let's hear from Dave. All right, Dave, welcome back to Small Batches. I know you've been on the show before, but can you give an introduction to the listeners who do not know you yet?
Well, last time I was on the show, we were discussing someone else's book. Now I have my own book. So yeah, I wrote a book called DevOps Patterns for Private Equity. I generally work with private equity portfolio companies every day, teaching them lessons that I've learned from the DevOps movement, from books that I've read, from things that I've thought about, really trying to help those companies achieve the investment thesis that the private equity firms that own them are trying to accomplish. I really only work with software companies. So from my website and all that other stuff, what I'm trying to teach them is how to get good at delivering software.
And that's actually one thing I really appreciate about your book. I know you're positioning yourself, like you said, you work with private equity firms. And I think one thing you do really well in the book is speak the language of executive leadership. You talk about, you know, the benefits to the business, the certain ways of working that we need to do, like technically to achieve the business outcomes we want. But more importantly, you compress Deming, the flow framework, the DevOps handbook, like SRE, ops, IT, security. You compress so many of the important ideas from many different core books and different domains into what I think is actually the best introduction to a broad swath of knowledge that you'll find in a single book. I'm not sure if you intended to do that, but it certainly came out that way. I know you have private equity in the title, but I think there's something here in this book that is just DevOps patterns for success. It's like not even limited to private equity.
Well, thank you. That's super kind of you to say. Really, when I was writing the book, I was trying to create something that was very accessible to people to really get, like you said, to the heart of a lot of these core concepts, because it does say private equity on the cover. And I know, like, people who are working in private equity are under a lot of constraints, financial constraints, time constraints, this, and then whatever. And they're not going to sit down and read like a 600-page tome, you know, of all these things and whatever. So like, I'm just like, all right, I have a certain amount of probably leeway that people will allow me to explain these things. And I have to kind of get them accomplished using that constraint. And so, yeah, I pull from a lot of different places over a pretty, I would argue, healthy career in a lot of different areas, and really try to help people to focus in on the things that will deliver value and help them accomplish their business objectives.
Yeah, I know early on, or before we started recording, you mentioned something like a challenge, a common situation, right? You sort of lay out a goal within, say, 2 years. We're a business and we want to, you know, we want to have this feature. We want to have this business capability. We want to expand from like whatever our service area is. We want to grow like 3x, right? okay, well, how are you going to do that? You talk to them. We only release once a month, or like half, you know, everyone's, you know, every 6 months or something like that. Okay, well, right there on its face, you have a problem. Those two things, like, we want to grow by 3x, we're only shipping every 6 months. You have a problem right there. And in the book, you know, you lay out all the things around DevOps, continuous delivery, et cetera. Can you tell us why the formula behind DevOps is so applicable or so successful in private equity?
So like you're talking about this idea of like meeting your business objectives, we want to do this in 2 years or whatever. A lot of the firms that I work with have a, you know, what they call a 3 to 5 year investment thesis for the portfolio companies they buy. And then after that 3 to 5 years, they want to get rid of that company, and through whatever means, whether that's, you know, IPO or being acquired by somebody else or whatever. But really what they are trying to do, what their idea is that we can make this company better. We can level this company up. Well, DevOps, right? We have this whole practice of continuous improvement, you know, all Kaizen, all these things, you know, Gene Kim's second ideal in the Unicorn Project was improvement of daily work, or, you know, this is like such a core concept to us. And so if you can, you know, improve a company, then they get higher returns, higher multiples, all these other kinds of outcomes they're looking for. That doesn't mean that other companies aren't trying to grow, get bigger market share, all kinds of other things, but they don't have this sort of clarity of like, this is what we're trying to do. This is in the time frame in which we're trying to accomplish it. So things tend to sort of not be quite so focused. So like, I love the example that you gave with like, releasing once a month versus like once every 6 months. And you know, what I tell people sometimes is like, can you achieve your objective releasing once every 6 months? Maybe that's possible. I'm not saying it's not possible. A lot of it also depends on what your time frame is. But if you're really, like you said, I'm trying to grow like 3x in 2 years or whatever, if you only release every 6 months, you're really relying on a lot of things to go right sequentially, you know, like this is a lot. And like, I've been around for a few years on this planet, and like, I just don't see everything going right all the time. That's just not a thing that happens. And so, you know, if I'm releasing every month or every 2 weeks or whatever, I think I probably made the point in the book, it's a lot more like Moneyball, right? I get a lot more at bats and I get a lot more chances to get things right. And like, for me, as somebody who wants to achieve all these things, I'd love to get more chances to get what I want done than less. And you and I both know that that all comes back to Deming's PDSA stuff.
Yeah, I think one challenge I continually find myself in is, I think I've reached the point in my knowledge of this area where it feels like it's all implicit and tacit knowledge. And so many things now just, for whatever reason, are, say, mutually incompatible or just make sense on their face. And I have a challenge like bridging that understanding with other people, right? And the way that you explained increasing the deploy frequency, reducing the batch size, getting more at bats, it's like one way to describe it, but there's more to it than that. I know you touch on it in the book too, you know, just another reason for the listener why I think that there's so much value in the book is there's the concept of releasing in small batches, like high deployment frequency, but also paired with the experimentation, like in the product, in the business, like feature flags, all these ways to decouple our assumptions and, you know, really get out there and start experimenting and learning what works, what doesn't. I know you've had clients, you've been around the industry. Has that changed how you communicate about these ideas to different people?
I think the thing I have, my challenge in my consulting practice is to be able to reach people where they are. So I am actually very practiced in coming up with metaphors and ways of explaining things to different people at different levels. You know, if you take any leadership courses at your business and, you know, they put you through leadership training, like that's one of the things that they teach you is you can't get people to come to where you are. You've got to meet your employees, your staff, where they are. And so, you know, I'm pretty good at coming up with metaphors. I come up with them on the spot a lot of times. You know, I used one with a client a few years ago that said, you have a lot of fires and a bunch of prominent arsonists. And like, they were like, what? But it was like, it was a very hero culture kind of an organization where like everybody wanted to get patted on the back for rushing in and fixing stuff, which is great if you don't really want to get anywhere. But, you know, we all know, like, if you want to get anywhere, you don't want to spend all your time reacting to things all the time, which is kind of the way that they were.
And I just had a conversation earlier today with somebody who we were talking about the negative feedback loop created by high amounts of high urgency, reactive work, you know, increase in work in progress, then the downstream effects of that. And you know, one thing I really appreciate too about your book is that you cover this from the whole perspective. Like, it's not just, you know, what's happening with an engineer, but to the business outcomes and to the psychology of it. Like, I'm glad that you mentioned hero culture. I had a conversation early on with somebody where I work, and they were kind of doing some like hero stuff. And I told them the business is going to succeed on the strength of its system, not by the work of the heroes. Right. And that was the introduction for this person into systems thinking and seeing that there's like a value stream here. There's bigger stuff at play than just like what I'm doing, which leads me to my next question for you and how you approach the broad topic of DevOps with your clients. You know, this sort of, I'm imagining it's kind of easy to fall into like thinking, hey, we should do continuous delivery first or this or that. But there's security, there's like the IT side, there's the SRE side, there's so many different sides of this. In your experience, is there a common entry point into these ideas?
In my experience, there is absolutely not a common entry point.
Oh, really?
Every company has their own culture, right? Every company has their own struggles. I had a client once where typically when I go in on an engagement with a client, I have kind of my own sort of way of doing these engagements, right? I do a lot of listening. That'd be the first thing. But like the first 2 weeks, I don't allow myself to ask any questions, really. I like interview people. I listen to what they say. I write it down. And I just keep my mouth shut because I don't really want to bias them in any way. And then for the next few weeks after that, where I'm listening, I will start asking probing questions. But I had a client where, you know, I was asking about continuous delivery and security and all these things, and everything that they described was like, great. Oh, we just started doing that. Oh, yeah, we started doing that 3 months ago. Oh, yeah, that's going really. Yeah, we did that. And I was like, I don't understand. Like, why am I even here if everything's going well? And what it turned out is like this company was really good at starting things and terrible at finishing them. And so like everything that I was asking about, have you ever thought about doing that? Oh yeah, we started that 3 months ago. They did. They absolutely started it 3 months ago, but they're not going to finish it. So like on the face of it, if I look like, are they doing continuous delivery? Yes, they're doing it in this one place and whatever. But like the real problem that needs to be addressed is like, how do we see these things through? Right. And, you know, you'll recognize some things in here about like project thinking versus product thinking and all kinds of other stuff like that. But it's hard to say like where the starting point is, because the starting point is what you just described like 3 minutes ago. The starting point is to look at it as a system and like stop looking at like, oh, well, we have to do this or we have to do that. It's like, what are we trying to do? Like, that's probably the first thing that we should tackle. And from there, we can figure out what can we do to make that happen.
You know, your answer is making me rethink a lot, actually, on my own assumptions. I had hoped that there might be a sort of at least a common entry point into at least this broad like set of practices. I could see how it's really different. Of course, it's like on a case-by-case basis, right? But there's like a set of ideas that underpin it, you know?
There's a lot of different areas you can dive into, but you know, where are you going to get the biggest bang for your buck? So like I do a quick, what I call a quick assessment, 2 weeks, you know, with somebody, and we write up a report and we rank, you know, the top five things you should work on from what you and I would maybe call a DevOps perspective, right? And they can be, you know, there's all like kind of accelerate kind of stuff, like trunk-based development or feature flagging or this or that or whatever. We just give them the top five. And so we did this for a portfolio company once, and the CTO was like, this is great. These five things you gave us, like most of them are on the list of 10 things that I'm doing right now. And I was like, what? 10? You can't do 10 things. He's like, yeah, don't worry about it. Like, you know, the five things that you talked about are on the list of 10 things. And we're like, dude, by the time you get the first three things done, the system will have changed. The things that are number 4 through 10 might be completely different at that point. So that's why we never give anyone more than 5. Like, maybe we should give them 3, you could argue, but like, I don't give them 10 because it makes no sense. Like, you're literally going to change the dynamics of the system in the process of doing this stuff. And so, you know, it makes sense to go after, fine, like 3 things, maybe 5. 5 is probably way too much, but 3 things, and that's about it. Because like, you can't fix everything everywhere, because it's all going to change underneath you.
Speaking of that, there is maybe a related question in your experience. I want to pick your brain about is, you know, you go on these engagements and you talked about like investment theses, and maybe these companies have like project or product roadmaps or like planned out to like quarters, half years or years or whatever. What's your experience been working with companies when they try to lay out this vision of what the weeks and months are going to look like? How do you deal with that?
So when I was at Salesforce, I was on a Scrum team and we were doing quarterly planning. So, you know, for the next 12 weeks, we're going to work on this, that, and the other thing. And we had all of our sticky notes and they're all on the glass wall and everybody's moving stuff around. And this is going to, you know, fall into this week and that's going to fall into that week. And one of the principal architects, this guy, Chris, he's a brilliant man, was like sitting kind of at the table. And by the time we're working on like weeks, like 10 and 11, everyone's arguing, no, this should go here, this should go there. We spent probably 45 minutes or an hour arguing about it. And he's just looking at us like laughing. He's just laughing at us. He's like, you fools. And we're like, all right, Chris, you jerk, you know, because you're laughing at us. Why are you laughing? He's like, what chance do you think that you guys are going to slot that yellow sticky note into that sprint 12 weeks from now? He goes, what do you think the percent chance is that that's actually going to happen? And we were like, oh God, yeah, you're right. it was like when you say it like that, yeah, it's absurd. And so like, you see all these like roadmaps for like all this time. And they're like, this is going to fall into the second month of the third quarter. And you're like, oh, like, what's the point? that's just crazy talk, you know? And like, I'm not saying people shouldn't plan things out. I'm just saying like, let's be a little bit more like fluid about like, hey, this is what we're trying to accomplish. What are the things we have to do to help us achieve those things or whatever? But let's not get like super caught up about things that are at a longer time horizon. Let's spend a lot more of our time on the shorter time horizon. And as we get through the shorter time horizon, that time horizon shifts and let's figure out what are the next things. And it doesn't mean that we're not planning or anything like that, but like, he was sort of saying like, look, for the next 4 weeks, you guys can get super precise about what you're trying to do. Trying to plan the thing for 12 weeks from now is like just bonkers. Like, what are you saying?
So do you think that like having teams create those plans and those roadmaps, it's one thing for the people involved to know that they're squishy, right? That there's a certain implicit degree of like, we don't have any clue about this part or whatever. But when those artifacts are presented to other people in the business, all that context is completely lost, right? And they just see, oh, March 15th, feature X, November 12th, big thing that I care about happening. And that creates this like psychological anchoring effect across teams and across like executives and leads or whoever, I'm curious, like, do you think that there really is value in even producing plans of that, like in that way anymore?
I think that, you know, just falling back on what we just talked about, like, let's say it's March right now. Like, if I want to say to someone, we're going to deliver this thing in, on April 5th or maybe May 1st or whatever, I think that's fine. I don't think it's fine to say we're going to deliver this on November 23rd, right? And that's fine. Like, we can describe things to people and be like, hey, this is going to land on March this. This is going to land on April this. But this is going to land in Q4, maybe early in Q4 or whatever. But like, there's no point in putting a date down on something that's sort of meaningless. Like, and I think to your point, I think that kind of creates a false hope. And so like, I've seen companies lay out like the quarterly things, and I literally got them to change it. So it said like first half of the year or second half of the year instead of quarterly. Because I was like, this is 2 years out, you know, and you and I know like the business environment's going to change in the next 2 years. And what's a priority right now may not be the same priority a year from now. And that's okay. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. That's just life. Like, it's cool. But why would we spend so much time right now? They're going to, you know, we're going to spend the next 3 weeks writing product specifications for the thing that's going to get delivered in 2 years. Like, really? You have nothing else you'd rather do with that time? Come on. Like, that's insane. So I think a lot of it, you know, is how you communicate it too, for what, for how you're setting people's expectations.
Yeah. And this actually leads me to the next point I want to discuss with you. And I think that you mentioned in the book, I know you talk about Kanban, I know you talk about Agile and Scrum in the book, but, you know, I've heard you say that, was it, it's like Agile is training wheels.
Scrum is training wheels for Agile.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So I feel like Agile is training wheels for Kanban and Lean to a degree. You know, in this example, right, we're talking about like this roadmap and you're doing this big like upfront planning. How is getting people on these kind of training wheels with Scrum, like how is that the training wheels into getting people to work and think differently, like on a day or week basis?
One of the things I did write in the book, and, you know, I'm sure we talked about, is as an engineer, one of the hardest things to come to terms with is you're never going to finish everything in the backlog ever. It won't happen. Like, and I write like, and I teach engineers all the time, like, give up, just like straight on, give up on finishing everything in the backlog, because it will never happen. I'm a Scrum team with, let's say, 8 people or whatever, and we've got 600 things on the backlog. You're never going to do 503. It's not going to happen. It doesn't matter, because number one, it might become obsolete. Number two, something else is going to become more important. Like, there's all kinds of things that are going to happen. So like, just don't bother. Like, just, it sucks. You know, lots of people have different rituals for this and Agile. Some people like to just close the tickets and they're like, if it's necessary, we'll open it again. I can't do that personally. Like, it offends my sensibilities. So I always move the stuff into what I call like the freezer, which is like sort of a board full of things that we'll never do, but it's not really gone because it's just in the freezer or whatever. Like, that helps my brain like kind of come to terms with it, and I'm at peace. And I'm like, I can always move it out of the freezer. Like, oh, I can always do that. So I'm okay. But then the thing that Scrum is really teaching you, right, is that we have a bunch of things that we want to get accomplished. And like, what can we get accomplished? And you have to figure that out. And so the reason that we have this time box, right, let's say it's 2 weeks, because everybody likes 2 weeks for Scrum for a sprint. What can we fit into the 2 weeks? And so like, when you're doing like, you're planning poker, and this is 3 story points, and this is 8, all of whatever. If my average team velocity is 20 story points for 2 weeks, and we decide that we're going to do 75 story points this sprint, that doesn't work. I can't fit 75 into 20. No matter how hard I try, I can't do that. So what are we going to do? we're going to, number one, focus on the things that are most important, which is why you're never going to do 503 on the backlog. And number two, we're going to break up the work so that it will fit into the 2 weeks, into the 20 points. That might mean that we're doing 21-point stories. I don't know if that's really the, you know, whatever, but like, who cares? Like, we have to fit it in and we have to be able to break it apart. And that's really what Scrum is sort of forcing you to do, is break apart the work so that it fits into this time box that you committed to. And then you have to deliver on the things that you've committed to. And Agile makes a huge deal about like the Scrum team being the one who commits to it, not the product owner, not the Scrum master, all the other stuff. The team commits to it, and then that's what they deliver. And over time, they start to learn like how much work they can get done in 2 weeks. And then like the planning poker and all that other kind of stuff starts to become a lot less important, because we've been working together. We know to break up the work. We know don't take on a 40, there's no 40, but there's no, let, don't take on a 40 point story and like say we're going to do that in the next 2 weeks, because that's nonsense. It's not going to happen. And so over time, you can start unloading a lot of the burdensome, you know, all the prescriptive crap in Scrum, because you start to know how to work together. And, you know, to your point about Kanban, most or almost all of the really mature Scrum teams that I've met, they drift into Kanban, like accidentally. They don't mean to do it, but after a while, they're like, why are we even bothering with the sprint? Like, why do we need 2 weeks? Like, we know how to break up work. We know how to deliver in small batches. We know how to deliver incrementally. We know how much work we get done. Let's just start doing work. And like, then it, you know, it, that's sort of where they go.
You said it, I read Sydney Decker's book recently, Drift into Failure. And the way you described it is drift into Kanban is like, yeah, makes sense. Like, I was thinking is training wheels, you know, sufficiently advanced Scrum is just training wheels for a smaller version of that across a variety of work streams. You know, like that drifting into Kanban happens once you are able to actually separate out the work streams, that like expectations for each one, the batch sizes, like what it looks like to do this. And then each of those having the different cues and different cadences of when work comes in, how long does it take to deliver, et cetera. Right. One thing
I have to understand the nature of your, you know, you have to understand how you work before you can do that stuff well.
Yeah.
That's why we're varying WIP, right? So that we get a better understanding of what we're doing.
Yeah. I think that the interesting thing too about Scrum is like, you mentioned that sort of like, I don't even know where it came from, but that just assumption that if you're doing Scrum, you're doing things in 2 weeks. And I don't know where that number came from, but I think if you just take that number and divide it by two, so you go from 2 weeks to 1 week, yeah, a lot of the rituals that you're describing and the structure is just no longer tenable in that time. So you then have to think more aggressively, and that accelerates the transition to something that's more like lean and less like agile. Like, I've seen it happen in teams, and I really like that. Just sort of my thoughts on it, but I do.
You want to force or encourage that transition is fine. But again, until people understand this concept of breaking work into manageable chunks and whatever, you can twist their arm all you want down to 1 week or whatever. They're still not going to do it right if they don't understand like those basic concepts.
Yeah, I think your point though about creating the rituals like planning poker, pointing, whatever you want to call them, like in the beginning they're useful for building that shared understanding. And then, you know, they're always hard in the beginning and sometimes like painfully so, but over time they become vestigial. You just do them implicitly, you know, and that's where the real value is, I think.
And, you know, you talk to Agile coaches and like, they don't care about 2 week sprints or whatever. They're like, you want to do 1 week sprint, do 1 week. You want to do 3 weeks, do 3 weeks. I don't care, because that's not the important part. Like, how many weeks you do is irrelevant. Like, the point is about breaking up the work, which is what most people get wrong with Scrum, right? Is they're like, hey, we got to do 2 weeks because it says in the book two. It's like, the 2 weeks, like nobody in Agile cares about the 2 weeks. Like it's just a number. This is a place to start so that we can start doing things. Like it means nothing at all. You could do 1 month sprints. Obviously the feedback loops are way too long and whatever, but like, as far as like what the time period is, like that's not really the point. So 2 weeks probably tends to be a time period where the feedback loops are short enough to help you adjust, and you know, but they're not too short so that you're not spending all your time in meetings. What I see a lot of people also conflate, which I don't know how this happens, is, well, we're doing 2 week sprints, therefore we release every 2 weeks. I'm like, what? Where did that come from? You know, like literally the Agile Manifesto says like working software. So like if the software is working, we release it. It doesn't say anything about working software at the end of the increment that we've chosen to plan how we're going to break up the work. Like, it doesn't make any sense. So I see it all the time, like all the time. And it's very hard to break people of that notion because they wind up planning things around it, right? We do 1 week of coding and 1 week of testing, and then we release at the end of the second week.
Creating our own little mini waterfalls.
Right? That's how they look at it. And you're like, no. I mean, yes, I can see how you jam those things together and it makes a lot of sense. I totally get that. But that's not really, there's nothing about that in Agile or software delivery or anything that makes any kind of rational sense. Like, you're just basically encouraging batch sizes of a certain size. That's what you're doing. But that's not small batches.
No, certainly not. Now, you mentioned one of the hard things is getting people to, you know, the real challenge is getting people to break down the work, right? And I want to change topic a little bit to something that you wrote in the book. It's a small little one sentence blurb, but it hit on a challenge that I have continually related to the production operations and SRE side, which is people assume that, let's just call them like monitoring and telemetry tools will tell you where the problem is. And I've been trying to explain that it's not the case. And I think you put it exactly what I'm trying to communicate to people in one sentence here, which is the secret to monitoring is to be able to easily confirm or refute a hypothesis. People just, you know, they come to Datadog and they're just like, open up Datadog and like, they expect to see a red error message that says, in this service, in this function, you're having this problem caused by this other thing and this other thing and this other thing. Was this a learned experience for you? Like, how did you come up with this just short description?
Probably working for years at monitoring companies, that probably helped, since I ran the, you know, global SRE organization for all the SolarWinds cloud companies, which were all monitoring companies. But yeah, there's a great article by Laura Nolan, who's brilliant, in like Login Magazine, the Usenix one, and something about high modernity and something in SRE or something like that. But she talks about like this idea of like techni and metis, and I am never going to get them in the right order. But like her basic idea was like there's certain kind of monitoring, you know, and Laura was like a SRE at Google. So she, in addition to being brilliant, she knows what she's talking about. This idea of like monitoring, which are like sort of, you know, what you and I, as we do this, like know is like the four golden signals, right? Your latencies, your saturations, blah, blah, blah. And like you can put those on a service and that's fine. Like that will tell you a bunch of stuff. And then she's like, there's a second level of monitoring, which you can only put on a service when you actually understand the service and how it works and what queues fit in, go, flow into what and where things can back up. And this, and that's a whole other level of monitoring. And like anybody who's ever done operations work knows, right? Takes a few months before you kind of get up to speed on an application and really start to understand how it works. And so kind of a little bit of what you and I were just talking about in that quote is like that second level of monitoring requires you to understand like how the thing works. And then when you understand how it works, if you do have an outage or whatever, you're going to have a hypothesis of what caused the outage, right? You're not just like, hey, stuff's broken. Who cares? I'm going back to sleep. Like, you can't do that. Like, that's not your job. So like, you have to come up with a reason why this thing broke. And if you don't have this thing already instrumented, whatever your hypothesis supports, then you need to be able to do that. And you need to be able to do that quickly, which means generally like shipping code and stuff like that, which I've seen people mess up, right? At portfolio companies where they like tie the Datadog or the New Relic or whatever, you know, releases or whatever you want to call it, to a software release. So like we've decided that we're only going to ship every 2 weeks. We do 1 week of coding, 1 week of regression testing. So we'll be happy to get your Datadog or New Relic or whatever config out 2 weeks from now. And you're like, I have the outage now. you can't do that in 2 weeks. And I don't want any of your emergency whatever's blah, blah, blah. So like, that's where that idea of like being able to confirm or deny a hypothesis is like, in the operation of any production service, we're going to have questions about what's going on. And we might have some basic stuff down, or we might have some pretty advanced stuff down, but that doesn't mean that like I have the answer to everything. And if you already have it, great. But like, you also, you know, to the flip side of that, you don't want to monitor everything that there is under the sun, because that's just going to cost you a lot of money for no actual benefit. So like, you know, you don't want to do that either.
I know, it's funny. One mistake, or yeah, I guess call it a mistake, I see new engineers in the operation space making is they just want to instrument everything because they think it might be useful, right? It's like you're packing for a trip and you bring every item in your closet. Okay, hold the phone. I mean, where are you going? You know, you're going to winter place. Like, you don't need to bring shorts. Like, be cognizant of the things that you're actually going to need. And I think I wish that more engineers would gain experience in the operations side, because I think, unlike sort of the software development side, on the ops side, you get to do a lot more science, like to that quote, right? Confirm or deny your hypothesis. Like, go think, do experiments. What's happening? Like, is there a performance issue? Okay, why? What's causing that? Like, you have to be much more empirical on the operations side than you do sort of in the coding side. And that's a different side of the work, a different side of the thinking, that like those two skills, I think, are different.
You know? I don't know how universal that is. I guess what I would say is, if you feel like that's happening at a company, then sit down with the engineering lead and be like, hey, let's run a game day. Do it in staging. I don't care. Don't do it in production. I know everybody gets all religious about all this stuff. I don't get religion about that kind of thing. But like, do in staging. Hey, we're going to turn off the database in staging. What's the application going to do? Oh, well, I think it's going to whatever. Great. Let's find out. What? No, let's find out. Come on. Let's sit down. Let's find out. And like, I think that also can really help people to with like understanding a little bit more of what you're talking about. Like, you bring some of these pragmatic things in, because, you know, when you get deep into the LFI community, the learning from incidents community, right? It's, resilience isn't about knowing everything or instrumenting everything or anything like that. Resilience is like the ability to respond, right, to stuff based on having a good mental model of the system, right? And it turns out, just kind of what you're describing, is like the operations people have a different mental model of the system than the coders do. The better you can bring those mental models together, the more resilience you actually really have. Because when something does break, people understand the system better. They understand how it works. There's a lot less, I mean, they're still guessing, but it's a lot more focused guessing, because you're not, you know, you and I have done this long enough. Like, I've been on, you know, calls where they're like, well, why don't we do blah? And you're like, well, what does that have to do with it? And they're like, I don't know. You're like, okay, well then let's not do that, right? But like, they don't have a very good mental model of the system. So they're like, well, maybe some things that I don't understand about operating systems are happening. And maybe those things are connected to some other things. And so therefore, maybe we should do blah. And you're like, okay, number one, that's not how the virtual memory subsystem works at all. which is fine. And I will spend time with you afterwards and we'll talk about that. And number two, let's not do that because we have enough trouble right now. And Hatfield's law, which is like, there's no problem so bad that it can't be made worse. So like, let's not do that.
You know, I just listening to you talk is making me think of one thing. I find that, you know, the more people I talk to and the more I try to introduce people to like these ideas, like managed work in progress, find flow, you know, DORA type stuff, lean, Deming, all these things, like the words, like what the phrase that comes up time and time again is mental models. And I feel like most of the work is just in coalescing people's mental models. Like if you can do that, then you're 10x improved to where you were before, right? Like that in itself is such a challenge. It's like communication, it's problem solving, it's alignment, it's the people problem, like the people side of the work, which is the hardest part of the whole thing.
Isn't that what a team is? Forming, storming, norming, performing, right? Like you're working out the mental models until people really start to understand each other and understand the things. And I think that's what a team is.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Dave. Well, thank you for coming on the show to discuss the book and a fun time talking to you. I'm sure we could exchange stories and everything for much longer, but it won't be much fun for the listener. So the floor is yours, Dave. Where do you want the listeners to go? What should they know?
I'm always thinking about stuff like this. I'm always thinking about different ways to explain it to people. You know, my mission in life, or at least in my business, is to make the lives of engineers better as much as I possibly can. Because like I wrote in the beginning of the book, when the engineers are doing better work, their leadership is happy because they're meeting all their targets and all their numbers. When they're meeting all their targets and all their numbers, the investors are happy. So I feel like I have one of the only jobs in the world that I could probably do where it's win-win-win, where I can really just make people's lives better and that will help. So I muse about this stuff like constantly. So you can go to mangotech.com, M-A-N-G-O-T-E-Q-U-E. And I have a monthly email that I send out for people. So definitely sign up for the email and, you know, hear about all kinds of crazy metaphors that I come up with to explain things to people.
Yeah. And if you like conversations like this one, you can join Dave and I in the Flow Collective, where we're both members. You know, the book is DevOps Patterns for Private Equity, Technology and Organization Strategies for High Performing Software Investments. I think there's something in this book for anyone listening in the audience. So if you're thinking about a book to give the leadership in your organization, go buy Dave's book, give it to your leads. You're not going to regret it. Thank you again, Dave. Thanks for making the time.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
All right, that's all for this batch. I need your support to keep this podcast viable. I've set up a Patreon to support this podcast and its cousin, the Software Kaizen Substack. Your support ensures I can continue producing small batches episodes just like this one and long-form written content on Software Kaizen. Go to smallbatches.fm/105 to a link to my Patreon, the free March giveaway, and a link to buy Dave's book. I hope to have you back again for the next episode. Until then, happy shipping.